Case number 13-5072, Judy Ann Gordon, appellant versus United States Capitol Police. Ms. Bowman for the appellant, Mr. Herrera for the appellee.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Sarah Fallman, and I am pleased to represent today Officer Judy Gordon. The issue that we're facing here is whether or not the district court erred in its decision to dismiss Officer Gordon's complaint for both FMLA interference and FMLA retaliation. And I think in order to frame this argument, we should consider a quote by U.S. Representative Mike Honda. Everyone in America likely has a bullying story, whether as the victim, bully, or as a witness. And we have one such story here today. Officer Gordon is the victim. The United States Capitol Police is the bully, and we as officers of the court are the witnesses. And it's up to us to decide how this story ends. I'd like to briefly discuss some of the facts that Officer Gordon alleged in her complaint. And these are facts that the district court was required to accept as true, but failed to do. After Officer Gordon's husband tragically committed suicide, she returned to work, performed her job duties as a law enforcement officer without incident. She then submitted an application for intermittent FMLA leave to be used in the future in the event that she suffered from depression and needed time off to deal with that. She submitted it to the Office of Human Resources, who looked at her certification request and approved it. Unbeknownst to Officer Gordon, however, her supervisors in the field were not so keen on following the FMLA. In fact, the inspector, one of her direct supervisors, had expressed anger that his officers were requesting and being approved and using FMLA leave. And when he finally saw her approval, he was angry, and he told another supervisor of hers that he vowed to find a problem with her request. And he did. And that problem was based solely on his dislike of FMLA leave. 2 months after Human Resources approved her request, before Officer Gordon had used any leave and not in connection with any sort of troubling or suspicious behavior, the Capitol Police revoked Officer Gordon's police powers, sent her to a burdensome and unwarranted fitness for duty evaluation, and as a result of that, did not allow her to work 2 days of previously scheduled overtime. And that's 2 full days. And it took these actions precisely because she submitted a request for FMLA leave. Those actions harmed Officer Gordon. She lost hours, and the fitness for duty exam, the very fact that it exists in her personnel file, will have an impact on her future promotional possibilities.
Can I stop you? The 2 days of overtime that she was denied, is that because of the delay between the fitness for duty exam and the one-day conference?
That is because she was stripped of her police powers, and without those powers, she was not, the Capitol Police would not permit her to work those 2 shifts that she had previously scheduled.
And that was during that 2-day period?
That is correct. Okay. It occurred during, it's a 5-day period from when they stripped her of her police powers until she was ultimately reinstated.
Okay. Ms. Fallman, the record reflects that she was seriously depressed, and at one point talks about her being incapacitated for up to 3 days, and it wasn't entirely clear to me when that was. Did she have periods of 3 days off? Because the complaint alleges that she was working continuously without interruption and, in fact, had yet to use or cash in on any of the approved FMLA leave when the allegedly retaliatory action started.
She had not used any leave and had not suffered any of these attacks or these episodes. She had submitted a request in the event that it happened in the future so that she could immediately take time off if she needed to. but she didn't need to. She was going to her regular therapy sessions and was proceeding, doing her normal law enforcement job duties. Nobody raised a question. She didn't raise any issues that she was having. What happened is her inspector found out, because he received a copy of the approval, that she submitted a request. He didn't like officers submitting requests, and so he took action against her. And I think what we need to talk about now are the errors that the district court committed. And there are many. And turning to the interference claim, the district court stated that she could not make a claim for FMLA interference. And that's based on three fundamental mistakes. The first is it effectively found that she needed to be actually denied leave. And that is not required under this circuit's decision in McFadden. The second is that it ignored the facts that showed that she was denied FMLA entitlements. And those are the certification entitlements, what the Capitol Police is entitled to get, when, and whether or not they can do a fitness for duty evaluation, and if so, that they have to provide notice of it. The third...
Is there any authority for any federal employer to require... I mean, we're looking at whether she was discouraged from using this, and it seems to me if any employer requires her, requires an employee to sign a waiver authorizing the employer to talk directly to a health care provider, that's a really disturbing, it could certainly lead to discouragement. Now, is there anything in the regs?
There is. There is.
I can understand if you're saying I'm facing surgery and your employer says I'd like to get some sort of verification of that. But this goes, your allegation anyway, goes far beyond that to require an employee to waive doctor-patient privilege, in this case the therapist, and have the employer talk directly to that therapist.
That's correct. And actually the regulations, both those issued by the Department of Labor as well as those by the Office of Compliance, and they're required to be substantially the same, have stated that all the employer can do is ask the employee to let them contact the doctor to verify what the doctor wrote in the certificate. In other words, that the diagnosis is depression and that they are seeing that patient. They are not permitted to ask them open-ended questions, and even beyond that, they sent her to another doctor, one that is not hers, and she had to submit 921 answers to additional medical questions.
So that is a violation of the Act, regardless of interference or retaliation, right?
It constitutes an interference claim. Under the regulations in 220C, any violation of the regulations constitutes interference. And I'd like to quickly and I want to reserve a couple of minutes for rebuttal, but the district court also committed some pretty serious errors with respect to the retaliation claim. The first thing it did is treated this not as a motion to dismiss. It required that Officer Gordon demonstrate pretext, which this court does not permit, and it found that some of the factual allegations she made, it felt, were not credible, and then credited an attorney statement, nothing made by the Capitol Police, but a statement made by the then defendant in a court hearing or in a court brief. And another problem that the district court faced with its retaliation claim was that it found that there were not adverse actions. And the record is clear that there were a number of adverse actions that were taken against Officer Gordon precisely because she filled out that FMLA request.
As I understand, it's an open question, both in the Supreme Court and in our court, what the standard is under the FMLA, and in particular, whether retaliation and the degree of harm one has to allege to make out a retaliation claim under the FMLA tracks the standard of the Supreme Court in Burlington Northern. And you seem to say that you accept, and in your brief on page 21, you accept that the standard of alleged harm is something that might dissuade a reasonable worker. And I wonder if you think that's legally required or whether, in fact, that's Burlington Northern might not be applicable to the FMLA.
I think the standard under Burlington Northern is pretty applicable here, and it tracks well what happened. If you look at the situation in a whole, the pertinent question is, would a reasonable employee submit a request for future FMLA leave if he or she knew they would be stripped of their police powers, which could mean the end of their career, denied overtime pay, which they had been guaranteed to work 16 hours, sent for a fitness for duty examination, and forced to sign a waiver giving their doctor permission to speak to somebody with their employer. And I don't think a reasonable employer would find that objectionable. And the
so you think you easily meet the Burlington Northern standard? You have no reason to question it here.
I think we easily meet that. And I'd like, unless there are any further questions.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Herrera?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Frederick Herrera. I represent the United States Capitol Police in this action. Officer Gordon is a police officer who carries a weapon. The department has an interest in making sure that the public is safe and that Officer Gordon is safe while she's working her hours at the Capitol Police. In this case, Officer Gordon submitted a FMLA request where she alleged two things. She suffered from severe and incapacitating depression with treatment that would last up to 3 days, and without treatment that could be 3 or more days. That's a very serious allegation or a disability in which the department...
It is alleged in the complaint. We have to assume it's correct for these purposes.
Correct.
That in fact the decision to have the FFDE, for example, was not based on that. It was based rather on an attempt to discourage her from pursuing these rights.
Well, she does allege in the complaint two paragraphs. One, that in the discussions with her supervisors, that they said that they were sending her to a fitness for duty based on the allegations in the FMLA complaint. And she does allege in the complaint that her supervisor says to her, we assume it's true, what if you hurt somebody? And those both become a very important factor asserted in the complaint as to the basis for the fitness for duty. This case is very similar to Wisby.
You're selecting certain portions of the complaint. In a way, it's quite admirable, perhaps, on her side that the complaint has some material that's not particularly favorable, but it also has material that's highly favorable to her claim. Right?
That is correct.
In terms of the purpose behind the FFDE.
It is, but again, this case is very similar to Wisby versus Lincoln, Nebraska, which was the Eighth Circuit case. In that case, there was a medical dispatcher who applied for intermittent FMLA based on a depression condition that she had. And part of the depression condition was that she was unable to focus. She was sent for a fitness for duty evaluation when the supervisors learned of her condition because they were worried about her ability to perform the essential functions of the job.
Mr. Herrera, there's nothing in the record that I'm aware of, there's certainly nothing in the complaint, and that's the record at this stage, that would support this notion that the Capitol Police was concerned about someone seeking any kind of benefit based on depression, and that if they really had a very urgent need to protect the public against such a person carrying a weapon, wouldn't they have some kind of triggering guidance in place to detect that at the moment the HR person got that FMLA request? This was months later when the supervisors, it dawns on them that, I mean, even under the most favorable reading to you of the complaint, that which, of course, isn't the standard we legally must apply here. So I'm just wondering how you can even make that argument here in court today.
Well, some organizations, I think ours included, has a stovepipe structure that sometimes can be problematic. HR approved it without the division knowing the operations piece of this puzzle. When the operations side learned of it, that's when the fitness for duty triggered her ability to perform the essential functions of the job. But I go back to the basis of the FMLA and the case law. What an interference case requires is that a benefit is denied. There's no allegation in the complaint that there is a denial of a benefit.
The interference language is taken straight from the National Labor Relations Act. All it requires is interfering with, restraining, or denying the exercise of the right provided. How are you suddenly leaping into the idea that a right must be denied?
I would cite to, starting with the Supreme Court case law, which talked about interference in Wolverine Worldwide Incorporated, that there has to be...
Well, it says there has to be prejudice.
Two parts of it. One, that there's a denial of a right, and that there's prejudice.
No.
But the right is to be free from interference, and interference is defined to include hindering and getting in the way of someone enjoying the leave that they've been afforded.
I'm not sure that the right is that narrow. I think if you look at Wolverine Worldwide, they actually say what a denial of an FMLA benefit is in that case. They say not giving the employee their FMLA notification. They talk about an employee trying to use leave and it's denied. They talk about situations where an employee is entitled to have their benefits and those benefits are denied. They talk about a situation where notification is supposed to be given to the employee of the 12-week entitlement, and some companies don't give that.
I don't take it that it's your view that if an employer harassed an individual who had, you know, banked some FMLA leave, who had gotten an approved allocation of FMLA leave, and they just every day said, you slacker, you know, if someone's pregnant, you baby machine, you know, every day harass them, surely that's interference. Or the way you're legally reading it, no.
I'm not seeing any of the Court of Appeals even taking that position, because if you look at each of the cases, including Quinn is the Eighth Circuit case, which talks about that kind of situation, discouraging the employee from using FMLA. But at the end of the day, the court looked at it and said she received all 12 weeks of her FMLA entitlement. And because she was not denied an FMLA entitlement, she didn't have an interference claim.
With respect to the Eighth Circuit, if you count that, that's a flat-out misreading of the statute. Right? There'd be no point in the other language if a denial were required.
Well, again, I keep going back to the case law. Even the case law that plaintiffs or Ms. Gordon, Officer Gordon, cites, there's a Sixth Circuit case which gives the analysis or at least the prima facie case for interference. And one of those elements is that there is a denial of an FMLA benefit. So that's the consistent reading of the case law in terms of a denial of a benefit, and that's what Judge Leon relied on in making his decision. Let me turn to the second point, which is the opposition clause. I think what there's an overbreadth reading of the opposition clause with respect to the Family Medical Leave Act. 2615A1 talks about the exercise of the FMLA rights. Under the 2615A2, the language of the FMLA says that you are protected from discrimination when you oppose a practice made unlawful by the FMLA. That opposition is an essential element to the retaliation case. Interestingly, what the court seemed to have done is incorporated the first element of a prima facie case of whether an employee is engaged in protected activity. But with respect to the opposition clause, that only covers the second part. So unlike the building of the protected activity from Title VII, which has both a participation and an opposition in the statute, if you look at the FMLA, 2615A2 only discusses the opposition piece of the statute. So the first question here is there anywhere in the complaint where Officer Gordon opposed a practice made unlawful by the FMLA? There is simply no evidence of that in terms of the sending her to the fitness for duty, and so the retaliation claim fails on that respect. The only part of the complaint where one might assume there might be some retaliation or some opposition was when she was to be sent for training in October 19th, and she says, wait, I have a therapist appointment. But in that case, there was no adverse action. Nothing happened, her leave was approved, and there was no adverse action that flowed from there. So the opposition clause is not satisfied under the FMLA in this case. I would argue that because of the case law in this case, it's very clear that in order to have an entitlement benefit under 2615A1, there must be a denial of a benefit. In order to have discrimination under 2615A2 or retaliation under A2, there must be an opposition. In this case, reading the complaint in the most favorable version to Officer Gordon, there simply is not the elements necessary to establish a claim under either of those charges under the FMLA. Accordingly, we ask that Judge Leon's decision be affirmed and that this court rule in the favor of the Capitol Police. Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does Ms. Fahlman have? Okay.
I will be brief. When I was up here previously, we discussed quite a bit the idea of denial of a benefit, and there were many benefits denied to her. One is the ability to be free from any sort of certification requirements other than those set forth in the regulations, and the Capitol Police violated that. And the other is the right to be free from pursuing a claim without discouragement, and the Capitol Police violated that. Now, turning to the opposing a practice, a number of courts, including the Sixth Circuit and the Eleventh Circuit, have specifically found that this element can be satisfied by either requesting or using FMLA leave. And indeed, this court, after a de novo review in 2003, affirmed a district court decision that found that requesting leave constitutes protected activity for purposes of an FMLA retaliation claim. That was Hopkins v. Grant Thornton at 529 Federal Appendix 1. And also of note is in the court below, the Capitol Police conceded that when she submitted her request, she was engaging in a protected activity. They conceded that, and the district court noted that in its decision. They have now changed their mind.
Do you need both claims? I'm not sure what work it does for you to have, in effect, two different characterizations of the claim.
At this point, because we have not yet engaged in discovery, I'm not sure that I can say that both claims are not necessary. I think that that's part of the problem with where this case stands, is that the court improperly dismissed her complaint before she had the ability to engage in any discovery, and the complaint clearly sets forth enough facts that create a claim for both that are plausible on their face, which is all that's required. If you have no further questions.
All right. Thank you.